We find a home for Zach LaVine with the trade machine. The Clippers are still trying to figure out how to play with James Harden, and Dan goes deep into the psyche of Draymond Green. All that and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome back to another edition of No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher. I am a senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. Joining me as always, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. It's my man, your man, everyone's man, Dan Devine. What's up?
Jake, I'm feeling good. John Gennaro just told me I look like a monk, but I feel more like a pirate. NC Armada, let's set sail!
We are captains on the ship into the stormy waters of nightly league pass games. I am not feeling good. My legs feel like total crap after playing pickup last night for the first time in 2 months, but we are here.
No. We can't just breeze past that. How did you play?
So I played very well in the first game when I wasn't dastardly tired, and then I played pretty poorly after that. But the first game...
Back-to-back's always tough.
We came out of the second game, and the guy who was defending me was like, man, you're making me look bad out here. And then I said, ha, famous last words for me. And I was correct. It's very tough to realize that my youth is just sapping from my body every bounce of the ball.
Is it tough for you to realize that, Jake?
It has been tough. It's been a tough realization since I was like 26. So I turned 30 at 26, physically. Maybe not mentally. Maybe not
mentally.
I turned
30 at like 13. Yeah, I think I've had this energy for a while. But I'm glad that you got out and played. But you did what you missed while you were out. A whole sweeping night of NBA basketball that we will start to discuss.
I did come home to catch up on a couple of games. I watched the end of Boston Philly, and I realized that those are the two teams I need to not watch for a little while. I've injected too much.
Front loading the season with them. Yeah, there's a lot of them early.
But the team that I feel like no one can get enough of is the Clippers' ongoing tailspin, which they are now 0-5 with James Harden, but they are soon to be expected to be signing Daniel Tice, who I watched in Manila absolutely obliterate Team USA and be an integral member of a gold medal team. But I think the Clippers, I mean, I know the Clippers were turning over every stone they could on the center market, to the point where they even, according to my sources, brought in one Kai Jones for a visit of some capacity, who I'm not going to say too much on the former Charlotte Hornets first round pick, but doesn't appear to be in mental or physical condition to be playing an NBA game right now. So I just say that to say that shows the breadth of the Clippers search, and I think it's a much better outcome that Daniel Tice is on this team. I don't know what we're going to see from him. We haven't really seen Daniel Tice play in the NBA consistently for a long time now. But if you're holding that glimmer of FIBA hope, I don't know, Dan. Do you think just a serviceable backup five will lift the Clippers to considerable just relevancy? Or do you think that maybe the issues are bigger than someone who's going to play 18 to 24 minutes a night for this team?
I think if Daniel Tice is playing 24 minutes, and there's maybe, you know, either he's awesome or there's bigger problems. But yeah, I'd love the sort of conceit of like there's an infinity gauntlet that Lawrence Frank is holding or whatever, and it's like Kawhi, PG, Westbrook, Harden, and then like right in the middle there, Daniel Tice, and now we're at full power. Yeah, I mean, when Mason Plumlee went down, it was like everyone looked around and realized like, oh, there's not another guy over 6'6" or 6'7" here. There's not another center that we can play out there. You really saw it come home to roost the other night against the Nuggets, where like it was like the best the Clippers have looked front to back since they got Harden. But when they got, you know, when Ivica Zubac was off the floor and they're playing PJ Tucker at the five, and they just don't have another even like sizable body to put in the pathway of, you know, Nikola Jokic going to the rim, like the need for another body there was important. And like, as you mentioned, we haven't really seen much of Tice in the last couple of seasons in Indiana. but when last he played regular minutes, he was a pretty good pick and roll dive guy, you know, in Boston. He's somebody who's like a little bit of stretch to his game. He's a physical defender, a smart positional defender. You know, I imagine that Ty Lue will, you know, be able to use some of his versatility and get him in the right spots. Like, he could be a useful contributor. The bigger questions, though, obviously extend much, you know, far, far beyond that. And this has been a week for sort of talking about that, like Ty Lue, and there was a, you know, Chris Haynes over at Bleacher Report had a big story about sort of the inside of the early running of that. And Ty Lue to Chris Haynes, quote, "This is my toughest challenge as a head coach, but I'm up for the task for sure. The biggest thing is getting these guys to sacrifice for guys, whether that's starting the game, finishing the game, shots, touches, who's running pick and rolls, things like that. Getting these guys to sacrifice will be the biggest challenge all season," to which you can only kind of say good luck. You know, we're a week in and we're already at the numbers are wild. Minus 70 in 161 minutes with Harden on the court, plus 24 and 79 with him off it. They're scoring like
that's
the
worse than Zion Williamson numbers.
Listen, you, this is just you checking to see if Joe Garza is listening to the show. I see where you're coming it from is. Here. They're scoring like the Blazers with him on the floor. Not like the Dame Blazers, this Blazers, which is less good than that. They've been outscored by 10 points per 100 possessions with all of Harden, Kawhi, PG, and Russ on the floor. None of the other combinations have really been all that good. And so like that's the thing about, you know, it was a funny line like when Harden said, like, "I'm not a system player, I'm a system." He's not wrong, and adjusting to a new system takes time. And you're starting to see a little bit of that. Like, already Ty Lue is saying, like, he's going to go on the ball. Russ is going to come out a little bit earlier. Bones Highland, you're going to go take a seat for a while we try to figure this out. And there's everyone's saying, you know, give it 10 games, give it this amount of time. You know, like, we need some runway to figure it all out. It's starting to get there. But it's going to require, as we've said before, all of these guys agreeing to do stuff they've just kind of never wanted to do before. It's cool to see Kawhi occasionally set a screen for in a random setting. That's good. More of that. It's cool to see Harden. It was actually legitimately funny. He's told Tomer Azarli of Clutch Points. And I hope I'm saying Tomer's name right. I believe I am, but I might be wrong. Said like the biggest thing he's learned in five games is that I have to shoot the catch and shoots. There haven't really been a whole lot of catch and shoots for me since OKC. Dog, that's because you don't do it. Like, they wanted you to do it. And every time it gets to you, you kind of like shake into a sidestep dribble and then into a pull up. Like, it's been there for years and you just haven't done it. So all that to say, everybody's trying to adjust to it. Daniel Tice probably won't hurt, but it'll only help but so much if the other guys don't get accustomed to doing the things that they don't really feel like doing.
Trust me, I can tell you that the catch and shoot three thing is something the Clippers were very trying to harp on from the get-go. That was kind of when they came
as were
here
the Sixers, as were the Nets. Yeah. Like, everyone has wanted more of this. And it's like, first, so for Harden to say, like, "Man, that's something I learned in the last five games," that's wild. But you know, who knows what he'll learn in the next five.
Well, look, he is not wrong in that if you give him a dive man and run high pick and roll play after play after play, you are most likely going to be getting a good look on most possessions. But that type of system worked a lot better objectively. Obviously, we're scratching a broken record and remixing it over and over again. Like, it's not the same when you're now 34 and when you have Kawhi Leonard and Paul George on your team. The Russell Westbrook balance, I think, might be getting a little bit overplayed just because he's Russell Westbrook and his name is in big blinky lights. Because honestly, what we saw from him last season going from the Lakers to the Clippers into more of an energy roller type of position, like the Bruce Brownification of the NBA, where now I see any guy under 6'6" doing anything big man like. That's like the new Draymond Green. Like, for a while it was, oh, there's all these Draymond archetypes. Like, even like I watched Jaden Springer and with Philly, and I'm like, oh, it's a Bruce Brown type guy. Right. And that's kind of what Russ was doing last year. We saw the effectiveness in the Denver game, cutting baseline. I saw Nate Jones tweet out something like, "We give LeBron all this praise, rightfully so, about his still breathtaking athleticism at his age. Westbrook's burst at his age is still ridiculous too." And
after knee surgeries too, like, it's, you sort of forget about that, but that's, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. In general, I actually heard a couple of guys saying this on the way into the pickup high school last night. They were not in my run. They were in the other run. There was two gyms. These guys were a lot bigger, and I was happy they were not going to be on our court. If LeBron wasn't doing what he's doing, just like if Steph wasn't doing what he did throughout his career, like Dame's status of being this all-time historic three-point shooter would have been a thing. LeBron is overshadowing all these other guys playing well past, you know, 32, 33 and doing it at all-star levels. It's kind of crazy when you really step back and look at all the numbers. But the Clippers don't have them all gelling at the same time. And it's just, it's going to be, it wouldn't be such a big storyline if there weren't such high stakes in that. You talk to anyone around the league, they are kind of looking at it with a little bit of glee about, you know, this could be a one-year thing before they go into this stadium where everyone is happy to whisper about, you know, Bob Myers is still out there and blah, blah, blah. It's just, there is a lot at stake. And the fact that these are all very good players that most teams would be happy to have a discussion with if they were a free agent, when this, mostly all these guys could be on the open market next year. It's just going to continue to be a talking point until it's not. And that's on all the primary actors involved to zig in the same direction and get this thing going, because you can keep saying you need 10 games, but you're halfway there. And I mean, I know the Clippers were 0-5 with Russ to start as well, and the ship turned around and Captain Barbados came and took things to the right direction and they made it the playoff run before Kawhi got hurt again. But it is a long season and they clearly have a lot of runway to steer this in a better direction to a better beach, to continue with this metaphor.
But let's keep continuing with the metaphor. Hammer this
sucker.
Keep
it going. Yeah, I think it's going to be harder when every loss is being covered and felt on the ground like a big UFC undercard that only happens once a month. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, speaking of a UFC undercard, I was not planning that transition.
Come on, Draymond Green, you had to have planned that out. That's too good.
Sometimes, you know, you're just that good. It just falls out of the sky.
Yeah, you're a conduit. It just flows through you. I love it.
It's like I interviewed Lil B years ago, back when I was in college.
The Bass God? Oh, man. The Bass God.
About his John Denarger Ready to Bleep This, about his Kevin Durant song. That's probably one of the first stories I ever got paid for as a freelancer. So shout out the Bass God.
Absolutely.
He told me that the Bass God was the spirit that embodied him. And he was only an instrument for the Bass God to deliver his messages to the world. So that's what these transitions are. That's what Draymond Green has always kind of professed and protest, that he is Draymond. He is him. You cannot control him. You cannot tell him to change. He is going to be authentic no matter what, and victories are going to come. And apparently all that authenticity includes choking out Rudy Gobert, which I just want to say, from my intro into this, I did not know. I found out this happened from Paolo Banchero. I was standing in the Magic's post-game locker room waiting to conduct one last final little interview for a story I'm working on for OneYahooSports.com. And I've been generally surprised this season how most post-game lockers I go to, every single player is just head down on the phone.
Yeah.
That's been very, very, I know it happens, but it's been something I've clocked. It just seems more prevalent this year. But in the Magic locker room, they were on their phones watching games and watching clips. And when the Draymond incident occurred, it's bigger than Draymond, of course, but when an NBA player takes a 7-foot-1 monster in a chokehold and drags him several feet across the hardwood, that's gonna get the billing. And just watching the Magic players come together around Paolo's phone and kind of giggle to themselves, like, oh, this is actually happening right now. Just like we would do at home or on our phone or whatever. It was such a joy to watch just the youthful exuberance of the plucky underdog building towards a playoff team, Orlando Magic. And pausing there, it is a big deal, though, to lose someone of that magnitude for five games. And it's just like another thing on Draymond's list of things that will continue to increase his punishment level when the next incident arrives, to the point where I've been saying this for a long time, partially because he chastised me for asking a very fair question at the 2022 NBA Finals, that at some point, we were talking about this before we started recording. At some point, self-awareness is more beneficial to just throwing it all out there and saying, you got to take me or leave me, because this is what I'm bringing. Like, he's about to retire and make a lot of money being a media personality. So I'm sure his response would be, F off, and I'm going to keep doing me. Look how much success I've had. But I'm over it. Like, I didn't find it that funny. To me, it was like such an eye roll and kind of like a, what the hell are we doing here, man? I don't know. What was your response, perception of the event?
Yeah, I mean, multiple things can be true, right? And so for the from the initial point of it, of you've got Jaden McDaniels tied up with Clay. Well, actually, so before we get into it too much, if you are listening to this, you are on the Ball Don't Lie podcast feed. Vinny Goodwill covered a lot of this on the Good Word with Goodwill yesterday, his solo show. So go back, check that out for his reaction to the suspension, et cetera. But initially, you've got Jaden McDaniels and Clay Thompson there tied up. And they're, you know, grabbing one another's jerseys, and they're sort of, you know, starting to square off. Draymond comes over and sees, because it looks like as Rudy Gobert comes over, he is putting his hands on Klay Thompson. And Rudy, then Draymond's response is to go and get him off of my teammate. And I, from the perspective of like, I can see that response, and I can see if you're from the component of your team. When everyone talks about like Draymond's the guy you want in the foxhole with you, that's why. That's one reason why. I see this guy going after my teammate. Job one is get that guy off my teammate. There is a point though where it's like you cross over to now you are the one who is doing too much. And as you've sunk in the rear naked choke and you are now dragging him along, that is where it goes, you know. As like your teammate, as your coaches are saying, let him go, like that's the point where it's too much. And there have been a lot of people that have responded to this and referred to this as like, especially the post-game comments from Rudy Gobert, where it's like, that guy's a clown. His coach knows it. Like, he doesn't want to keep playing because when I knew he was going to try to get himself ejected because Steph wasn't playing, and he doesn't want to play without Steph, which ties back into the reported thing from Pablo Torre Finds Out, where it's like the alleged comment that Jordan Poole had made was like, you're an expensive backpack for 30. So like the mounting backlash within the NBA community to Draymond Green of like, you are an appendage more than you are a driver of this success.
That's the thing, though. He doesn't care. To quote, I think, Amin Al-Hassan, like, your tears are PEDs for me. That's kind of his whole approach.
Right. But okay, actions speak somewhat differently than that, right? And like, whenever Draymond gets swiped at, he comes back three times as hard. And you don't do that if you don't really care. And I think there might be some sensitivity to that. There might be a sense of like, as players get older, especially players who are not, you know, mentioned earlier, LeBron overshadowing everybody with what he's accomplishing at his age, Steph Curry looking like he can keep doing this for five or six more years, whatever. Draymond's not that kind. He's special in a very, he's extraordinarily special, but he's special in a different way than that. And we've seen, like, as the deterioration of his offensive game has progressed year over year and injuries set in more, and, you know, when the circumstances are not lined up for him to be able to make the maximum impact, it, you know, either you need to get yourself to a place where you are competing at the level that allows you to make that difference, or sometimes if you don't have the facts, you bang the table. And there's a little bit of that with him. It's funny, though. I hadn't really thought about it But when you lined up that discussion of, you know, he's got the post retirement media career lined up, and I'm sure he would say, like, for, you know, fuck you, I'm winning, I did it right, like me being me the way I am all the time.
I got four rings. That's all that matters.
And a defensive player of the year, and he's going to the Hall of Fame, and, you know, generational wealth out of being, you know, the overweight kid out of Michigan State who goes in the second round. Like, it is a success story beyond any metric. But it made me think of, it's a weird memory, but like when Kevin Garnett was like fighting with Charlie Villanueva towards the end of his time in Boston. And it's like, it's less about the specifics of that. And there were ugly specifics of that, that were like Garnett making comments about alopecia. And there were weird things about that that were not great. But it was also like, you are one of the greatest of all time. And you are now, to keep yourself kind of on that razor's edge, fighting with Charlie Villanueva. Like, you are now punching in a different weight class. And that's not like, so maybe that indicates to the world that you are a little bit concerned about where you are in that weight class. And, you know, we don't think about that with Kevin Garnett now. You know, we don't think about the fact that when Kevin Garnett got into all those fights, it was primarily with, like, you know, Euros and guys that weren't necessarily, you know, considered
Dan,
to be
are
like...
Are you calling Europeans soft?
You know what I'm saying. I'm saying Kevin Garnett wasn't necessarily going after the bouncers and the bullies. Kevin Garnett was more frequently, you know, looking for guys that he could, you know, infringe on in that way. And it doesn't mean that, and we don't think of Kevin Garnett like that now. And Kevin Garnett has moved into a post-retirement media career where he is like this evangelist for the players of today, and like, and says things like, you don't get no infinite wiggles, and is like entertaining and really compelling. And I wish Area 21 was a more regular feature and all that kind of stuff. But there was that dip when it's like, are you starting to let go of the rope? And is that freaking you out? And is that, how does that manifest? And so, like, I don't know. Draymond Green could continue to be a defensive player of the year caliber impact player for a number of years to come. But you do wonder a little bit if some of this is like, you are starting to see, like, what looked like a far off horizon that you'd never get to is now maybe getting a little bit closer. And this, some of this is like the outgrowth of that. I don't know. Maybe
and
that's.
For, and for more psychoanalysis, you know, tune in next week for another edition of Divine Intervention.
Yeah. I'm sorry. It's the way my brain works. I apologize.
Let's move along to the technically biggest news of this week. Although Zach LaVine has been in trade conversation and rumors since this summer, but now it appears that he and his side are on the same page. And to me, I haven't made enough calls on this yet. I plan to write more either for Friday or early next week at Yahoo Sports, that his side is trying to maybe navigate the exit as opposed to getting dealt without having a say-so in the matter. But it's going to be a little complicated in that Zach LaVine has 4 years left of a Supermax contract where he has never played consistently on the defensive side of the ball. And he has been part of one winning team in 10 seasons that I am struggling to see so many teams that are going to be rushing to the altar to give, and I guess wed, the Chicago Bulls with multiple first round picks and a young player that, just looking at how the market works, I would assume will be Chicago's starting asking point. So for help to figure out some of these teams, super producer John Gennaro came up with some big trade ideas. So the first team up, the Miami Heat, where Tyler Hero's name was all abound trade discussion this summer. And I do believe Chicago's name came up, or the Bulls came up, as a team that was open to receiving Tyler Hero as part of three team shenanigans that would have, in theory, brought Damian Lillard to Miami. So Kyle Lowry's salary, Tyler Hero, and picks for LaVine and Alex Caruso, which to me be a nice get for Miami. I don't know how much better the Bulls will be receiving than someone who in theory has untapped upside and is young in Tyler Hero. especially looking down the list of other ideas that we have written down here, Dan, how appealing would that be to both sides in your perspective?
Yeah, my first blush thought, and I admit you could tell me if this is crazy, is like, if I'm the Heat, that's almost more about Caruso.
Yeah.
Because, well, A, I feel like Alex Caruso was like built in a lab to play for Eric Spoelstra. Like, you know, just defend everybody, go 1,000 miles per hour every minute you're on the court, to the point where like they have to artificially limit your minutes because they're worried you're going to break something if you go, you know, just, you know, the with your constant motor, feels like a very neat fit for Heat culture. Also, like, I'm not positive that Zach LaVine of today is like demonstrably better than Tyler Hero of today. And maybe that's just recency bias of like the Bulls have not been good. I've seen Hero in playoff series in the, you know, the recent past where he wasn't injured before last, you know, last, whatever. And I think Hero had a strong start to the season before he picked up a nick. But even if we accept like LaVine is a you know, more consistent, you get to the free throw line more often. He's a more consistent driver. He's a, you know, better finisher inside, you know, whatever those things are true. Is it true enough for it to be worth like a guy who's 5 years older and has knee problems and has an extra $45 million on his deal than Hero? So then like, to me, if I'm if that's like, I'm doing that math from Miami's side, I'm like, if I'm taking on this contract that you don't want on your books anymore, if you're Chicago, am I trying to like say maybe you don't get multiple future picks, right? Maybe the pick equity going out needs to be lower because I'm doing you a favor taking this off your books. And then if that's the case from Chicago's side, are you like, well, then I got to get quality back or it's no deal. I wonder if it doesn't matter. I like in theory the like it, I can see the Bulls saying like, well, we come out of this with a guy who's got all-star upside and is younger and is cheaper. And, you know, that, but I wonder if it's like, if it lines up quite enough for either side there.
Yeah. So again, these are fake trades and it's difficult to come up with deals where you need to match LaVine's $40 million in salary. So from a Philly standpoint, you know, Tobias Harris, John Gennaro has written down here, plus picks for Zach LaVine, which Tobias' salary checks out. 37, I believe, last year expiring. So you would get some nice salary relief if you are Chicago. That being said, from my understanding, I think the Sixers are looking to use the pick package they got back from the Clippers to add to Joel, Tyrese, Tobias, and DeAnthony Melton. That's kind of like the big four right now for Philly. If Paul George is saying the Clippers got four motherfuckers, those are the Sixers' four motherfuckers.
Shouts out to DeAnthony Melton. That's a level up for him. I love that for him.
He is. DeAnthony Melton's good, man. So would that be, despite that, would that be enough? Would that be enticing enough for you if you are the Sixers? Because it's pretty clear from the Bulls side. You get picks, you get long-term salary relief.
Yeah, I think, I mean, as a talent play, I could see it, but it feels like I could have made this argument, or it would be a clearer argument for me 2 months ago than it is now, right? Like now Maxi as a number one ball handler, shot creator guy that you want to have like a high 20% usage or whatever, like anything that introduces someone into the ecosystem who will take away from that without being like a clear defensive fit, which LaVine would not be. And also like not really necessarily a guy that you want running the second unit. Like that's the biggest problem the Sixers have right now is when Maxi goes to the bench, there isn't really anybody you trust running the second unit. So is LaVine that? I don't know. I'm not so sure that he's that you know, that kind of, he's a great shot creator, a great shot maker, three level score, but I don't know if he's somebody that you want to like throw the keys to and trust that he's going to generate offense for you, especially the goal for Philly is to find the guys that can make that work into the second round and hopefully beyond. So I don't know that LaVine's that guy. I'd also like if from the Philly perspective, that would mean an awful lot of responsibility and like you're crossing your fingers and saying a prayer that the collection of Nick Batum, Robert Covington, and Marcus Morris Sr., who has not looked particularly good when he's gotten on the floor, like that those guys can be your fours. With Tobias Harris out the door or whatever, you know, play one of the forward spots in big minutes for, you know, starting there or playing big minutes in the playoffs, that feels a little bit dicey to me. So I think the talent play makes sense to me, but the fit, if the Sixers had gotten off to a terrible start, maybe, but I don't know. That it feels like a, like the wrong kind of big swing for them right now.
So the Grizzlies are next. The Grizzlies would again, fake trades. They would trade Luke Kennard, Brandon Clark, Zaire Williams, and picks for LaVine.
So if I can break the fourth wall here a little bit, John, can you pot up for a sec? I want to know, like, was this based on a particular report, or did you just think, like, look at them and say, well, they're not doing so hot, they could use a shot in the arm?
Funny enough, all of these other trades I just came up with by myself in the trade machine. This one was, I found an article where someone else kind of had the same idea, like, hey, let's run through the trade machine and see what, and they were the ones who threw Grizzlies out there. And I was like, you know, that's not a bad idea. And this was kind of the package that they put together. I put it in the trade machine. It worked. I was like, yeah, sure. That makes some sense.
Okay. All right. I get that. And you, that perspective makes sense. Like, the Grizzlies definitely need a boost on the offensive end. I think they go into Thursday's games 28th in points per possession, 28th in half court scoring efficiency, 25th in 3-point accuracy. Like, they just, Desmond Bane is doing a level best to elevate that offense while Ja Morant's out, but they just desperately.
The Grizzlies roster without Ja is just bad. Without Ja and Steven Adams and Brandon Clark, it's just bad. Like,
I mean, in fairness, it's like, well, without three of their top six, they're bad. And yeah, I mean, that's true. Like,
You would have hoped, you know, David Ross, I forget the last Grizzlies game. I think it was the Jazz that ended up turning, like, there was like a close game and the Jazz blew it open within like 2 minutes of me turning the game on a couple nights ago. David Roddy hit like back-to-back threes. Like, you're hoping that one of Roddy, LaRavia, Zaire Williams, who they traded up, you know, in the draft and ultimately selected, which there's been thought around the league that he was not necessarily their top target, you know, like, truly no one since Desmond Bane has popped. Like, Santi Aldama is a solid player, but they haven't found any, like, just none of those lottery tickets have hit since their original core. And it's not to denigrate what the Grizzlies have done. It's just, that's, to me, as big of an issue as anything right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's why they did, why they sort of took so many bites at the apple, right? And it goes back to, you know, the initial trade of, I forget what the pick was, but to get Justice Winslow out of Miami, where it's like, you got to kind of take your shots at finding the guy, the wing that fits between your bigs and your guards, and see, so you sort of, you know, as many shots at it as you can possibly get. And they, you're absolutely right. It hasn't panned out. I mean, you hit the lottery with Ja, you hit the lottery with Jaren Jackson Jr. You have like a franchise shifting kind of thing when you land Desmond Bane in the 20s, but yeah, after that, it's, and Brandon Clark was another one of those late first round success stories, but it's a hard way to live. And they've not been able to be successful with the development of some of those other guys that they've brought in. So, I mean, the idea of Kennard, Clark, Zaire, and picks out for LaVine, it's obviously a significant talent upgrade. It would provide a boost for the Grizzlies on the offensive end. My issue as I look at that is like, all right, spin it forward a month, right? Now I've got to figure out the minutes and the lineups with Ja, Desmond Bane, Marcus Smart, and Zach LaVine. I still don't have an answer at small forward, unless you have, you know, you're playing Bane there more regularly, and that's a really small forward. What is the thing that, like, identity-wise outside of Ja that the Grizzlies have been missing so much? It's like they need the bigs that can offensive rebound and block shots and, like, free up Jaren Jackson Jr. to wreak havoc and then get them out in transition. Like, losing Clark was such a huge loss for them at the end of last season.
Yeah.
You forced all the possibility of getting him back and getting that kind of impact late in the season too. So it's like, it feels a little more like swapping deck chairs to me than it is like a solve for them. But that also might be the Grizzlies are in a position where there aren't a whole lot of great solves.
And also, like, I'm not expecting Memphis to do any type of panic trade here. Like, they are one of the organizations that is so dead set on preaching patience and not overreacting and not trying to introduce any variables into this great rebuild that they did that will throw things off the course that they already are. So something like trading for LaVine, I'd be kind of floored, especially with the lack of two-way effectiveness, where like someone like Pascal Siakam, which is the next fake trade that John Jarrett came up with. This is with just Toronto and Chicago straight up. Siakam for LaVine. Siakam obviously brings some two-way play. He would be the connective four-man that the Bulls have not had, that Patrick Williams has not evolved into, next to Nikola Vucevic. But are the Bulls, I mean, the Bulls have not shown a keen interest on fully blowing it up. That has been the talk for the last 18 months, that, you know, ownership has their six rings in the trophy case, or six trophies in the trophy case. And let's just get to the playoffs, baby. Let's collect that playoff gate. Let's put butts in the seats 41 nights a year because we got a competitive team. The last rebuild didn't work out so hot, where we got three straight number seven picks. One of them ended up turning into a trade that got Zach LaVine for Jimmy Butler. But this doesn't excite me for either side. I mean, does Chicago really want to then pay Siakam the $40 million plus that he's going to be wanting at the end of this year? I like it from a fit standpoint for Chicago, but when the financials come into play, and then Toronto, like, this is same thing you said with Tyrese Maxey. I think adding LaVine next to Scottie Barnes, when if the Raptors, who are the other team that right now everyone in the league is looking at as a potential blow it up seller at the deadline, are you going to add a $40 million a year player into that who's just going to stop the ball and take the ball out of Scottie Barnes' hands? That doesn't seem so appealing to me.
See, I can see it. I feel like I'll push back a little on the Toronto fit, because he would take the ball out of Barnes' hands somewhat, but he's such a dramatically different style of player that they haven't had with Barnes there, and would provide a level of bankable three-level scoring, guy who can get to the rim, guy who can pull up from mid-range, guy who's a catch and shoot and pull up threat from three, that in theory opens things up more for Barnes as a, you know, screen and dive guy, as somebody operating from the elbows. Suddenly you've got a handoff partner that can come off and pull. You know, there's the big wings in Toronto providing more defensive cover for LaVine, so that's not as much of a concern there. I can see that argument, but I agree with you just broadly. I kind of feel like I don't know that this makes sense for either side in this construction. I think if I'm the Bulls and I don't have any belief that I have a hard time. This is me, Dan Devine, speculating. I don't believe that Pascal Siakam would want to stay there. That doesn't seem like something that would make a whole lot of sense. And he's about to hit unrestricted free agency. And as you said, he's going to command top dollar once he gets there. And I don't know. So if that's the case, then I need picks if I'm the Bulls. And so if a straight up deal doesn't do much for me. And then for Toronto, if I'm the point of going and taking the big swing for LaVine is not to like subtract Pascal, it's to add to that. Like that, the construction of that deal that I think makes sense is something more like your expiring money. Like that's what you can offer Chicago in that deal, a bunch of expiring money and some picks. Like if that's Gary Trent Jr., Thad Young, Otto Porter, like 30 something million in expirings. And then, you know, if you like one of our young guys, pick them, and then, you know, a pick or something like that. So to me, I look at that and say like that construction makes more sense than like this, the straight up star for star. But star for star is maybe a more interesting thought experiment.
Well, the Bulls, him not wanting to stay long term, him being Siakam, is why John Gennaro put in a fun three-team version where Siakam would go to the Knicks.
Sorry, Jake, before you keep going, have you ever heard anybody write anything about the preponderance of three-team deals in the NBA? Is that something that you've ever seen anything about?
I did write that recently.
Oh, yeah. You wrote that recently at yahoosports.com.
Dramatic increase in three-team trades, and cap experts around the league, according to me, are preparing for an increase in such as the gymnastics surrounding the second luxury tax apron and all that stuff will continue to hamstring expensive rosters. But this scenario would have Julius Randle and our sweet boy Evan Fournier finally freed from Madison Square Garden. And I see here that you're not necessarily convinced that Siakam's much better than Randle. Is that what you're thinking?
That's not what the note in the Google Doc says. The note in the Google Doc says, is Siakam better than Randle, like definitively for sure worth doing the deal over? And so that's, if I'm the Knicks and I'm in that deal, I'm sending out Randle and Fournier, that expiring contract. And
don't say and Fournier, like it's a tough pill to swallow that you're losing a player who has not played for you in 2 years.
Right. But okay, fair.
But might have the greatest leg sleeve tattoo collaboration, whatever, compilation in the history of mankind.
Well, listen, I'm glad we got to Evan Fournier's leg tattoo on No Cap Room. It's something that's been on the vision board for a while, and I'm glad we got there today.
I see it every time I go to MSG. He warms up with about 5 minutes before the warm-ups end by himself. He's launching 35-footers wearing short shorts, and the ink is out on full display. I just want Evan Fournier to get a chance to play basketball.
That's to all display I, that's the leg ink. Yeah. I mean,
I want the leg ink on my TV.
Well, let's just clip and save that audio. The bigger point to me, though, so it's yes, you're right. It's not like it would detract from their rotation. It would detract a matching salary in a big deal that would be additive to what they already have. So that's my question. Like, if you're using the Fournier salary, and you know, if you would have to, you know, I'm guessing the Knicks would maybe have to throw a pick in there or something as well in that sort of construction. Maybe not. I don't know. Is to get Siakam in the door, like, is that enough of an upgrade in terms of your talent level and what the current Knicks structure would look like for it to be worth spending an asset like the expiring, like the Fournier deal? Whereas we've talked about like the Knicks thinking about what the next big star could be and who, what could they use to get into one of those conversations. And there's picks and there's salary, and Fournier is a big one of those. So that's the only, I think big picture, and it's something when you were on vacation this summer and I talked with Skeets about the Raptors, we sort of brought that up. Like, the Siakam is one of those like all NBA guys that people don't necessarily always think about as an all NBA guy, same like Randle. And maybe he's a cleaner fit in more places than Randle. Maybe he's a more versatile player than Randle. So I think there's an argument to be made that he is better front to back. Randle also has finally got on board. I think like 25-10-5 over the last five games. The Knicks are 4-1. The Knicks, with all the, you know, in terms of the underlying stats, are currently maybe like a top 6 or 7 team in the league, even though they're 6-5. So I want, that's the question. It's not, is he better? It's, is he better by enough for it to be worth the Knicks' while to make the deal?
Which is what ultimately front offices definitely ask.
Yeah, but all right,
all
no. Don't just host this one. You put me on the under the microscope to talk about it. What do you think about that question?
Well, I'm trying to keep the show going along here. Julius Randle is just such a mixed bag. Like, you come away from the Hawks game last night and you're like, man, this guy is a closer. He's a killer. He can get any shot. He can hit it from outside. He can bully you inside. He can play off the ball. He can play on the ball. And then there are games where the shots are just clanking off the side of the backboard and they're terrible 18-foot step backs on the baseline. And the defense is questionable. Basically, I'm just saying, to me, I think Julius Randle, I think part of why he is drawing the ire of Knicks fans and why his name is in trade chatter from just in the ether, not to say there's like actual things happening, it is because for someone at his skill level with his accolades, he's probably more feast or famine than most. And I've said this for several years now, the whole cliche of the best ability is availability. The best ability is consistency. When it's an 82 game season, and it's a grind, and you're playing 4 games in 5 nights, the ability to show up pretty damn near every night is as critical a skill as any. And that's just one that Randle lacks. I think Siakam is far more of a steady contributor to what he is capable of, where if you are the Knicks and you are at, I mean, watching that Hawks game, and when Dante DiVincenzo is hitting shots and Josh Hart is hitting shots, you start to look at the top eight and you're like, man, this team is pretty close to being at the top of the Eastern Conference, like right there with the Bostons and the Milwaukees and the Phillies. So just swapping out one of the more volatile variables for something more, you know, what you're getting every single night for 30 minutes, I do wonder. But that's a big, if you're sending multiple first round picks out the door when New York was clutching their pearls with Donovan Mitchell trade stuff to think like, okay, we need to save our powder for the true big number one guy. That guy is not Pascal Siakam. So I understand what your point was as well.
Jake, you know who I don't know what I'm getting on any given night, or who I don't know what I'm getting from them on any given night?
Who, Dan Devine?
The Los Angeles Lakers.
Don't know at all. And they are the next team, the final team here. The trade that honestly makes the most sense. LaVine went to UCLA from the West Coast. He is a clutch client represented by Rich Paul.
Famously in a t-shirt saying so the other night with Rich Paul in the front row at the, it was at the Champions Classic. Yeah, you know, here are the wares, you know, make your bids.
D'Angelo Russell, Rui Hachimura, Torian Prince, and picks for LaVine. This is the thing I like the most. The Heat thing comes close, but I think giving up Caruso is too much for Chicago in that scenario. D'Lo, Rui, Prince, and picks for LaVine. I think Rui was a nice find for the Lakers. He will probably never have the postseason run he had last season ever again. He couldn't miss. He was a human inferno that generated a nice contract that would be very valuable in matching up to Zach LaVine's $40 million salary. Will this make the Lakers better? I think the Lakers definitely need shooting as much as any team. Cam Reddish all of a sudden becoming a revelation and hitting game-winning shots in the corner. I don't know how sustainable that is, being that he has truly never been able to replicate that anywhere else in the NBA ever since he was a top 10 pick. Maybe he's playing next to LeBron, another clutch client, maybe playing next to LeBron and being Los Angeles and just wearing that purple and gold and feeling the history, feeling guys who put that jersey on, pat him on the back through the annals of Staples Center lore that is now the crypt or crypto, whatever the players call it. Maybe that's what's doing it. But if there's one thing Zach LaVine is definitely, it is not afraid to shoot when the ball swings to him. And sometimes, like, when you're watching the Lakers and the ball swings, like, you would rather have someone with a little more ability to do something than if it was Cam Reddish or Torian Prince or Rui Hachimura, despite all of Rui's great play. Torian Prince, when he's going, is one of the hottest shooters in the league when he's hot.
Yes, yeah.
He's got that high arcing moon ball that just through the net. And
just somebody turning that into ASMR, just freaking me out. All right. Oh, no, don't do more of it. Oh, no.
True reporting or sourcing to say this right now, if I had to make a wager on where Zach LaVine will be traded, I would bet it would be the Lakers for something like this. So what are your thoughts?
I mean, same thing. I think this is fine. I think the idea of, I don't know that you're going to get more out of D'Angelo Russell and Rui Hachimura than you got during last season's playoffs. So it's not necessarily like selling high on them, but it's more like you extracted the value from that transaction cycle that you could. And this is like, you are able to then sort of cycle it forward. And I think that's the position the Lakers are in. They need to be in. This is what being pot committed with LeBron and AD is. Like, you have to keep doubling down and doubling down and doubling down. And yeah, that can get ugly. I mean, it got ugly with the Russ deal, but then they were able to, you know, inside straight their way out of that. Maybe the LaVine deal with the $138 million over the next 3 years would be a similar albatross deal, you know, a millstone around their neck to figure out. But this is the cost of doing business. If you want to be competing with these superstar players and you want to be competing for a championship, there is no tomorrow. And like, the Lakers, maybe more than any other franchise, need to treat the future like it's fake. Like in 2031, you know, I don't know, we could all be, you know, have gills. Who the hell knows what's going to happen? You know, the world could be on fire and underwater at the same time somehow. I don't know exactly how it'll work out, but it could. And, you know, so the idea of burning your picks and burning your salary cap and whatever, like, if it gives you if it increases your chances this year, that they can really only afford to think that way. And I think LaVine would be, you're absolutely right, another catch and shoot option, another pull up option, another guy who can, you know, run a second side pick and roll, get downhill, create when LeBron and AD are, you know, bending the defense on the other side. I think that it makes more sense to me than the other ones that we've talked about, which of course is why it won't happen and he'll wind up, you know, in Orlando or something.
Orlando played Brooklyn on Tuesday night, as we discussed. Me in the locker room watching Draymond Green, or me in the locker room watching players watch Draymond Green.
Watching players watch him, yeah, right.
And I don't think the Nets are a team for Zach. I don't. That just doesn't seem to be the player that Brooklyn will be going all in for. But watching the Nets continue to be just plucky playoff team, where Mikal Bridges continues to be comfortable in an advanced role on the ball, playmaking, pick and roll stuff. I mean, when he is driving from the side into the paint, either side of the lane, he has that hanging fade that I think I've never seen him miss and I don't think will ever be blocked. We have a story coming out today. It'll definitely be live before this podcast reaches our listeners. I had a nice 35 or so minute chat with Mikal in the beginning of the season about just kind of staying the course and being the connective personality that he is. He's got a secret handshake with everyone in the entire building. Go to a Nets game. I was trying to see more film of it on League Pass archives, and my one critique of the Yes broadcast, which is hard because they have Ian Eagle and Sarah Kustak and Richard Jefferson to find things to be upset about. Too many cutting to graphics of the starting lineup or video of Giannis Antetokounmpo tying his shorts. I want to see the Mikal Bridges handshakes. And I would think Nets fans would want to too, because this is the guy who someone such as Zach LaVine, although it won't be to my understanding, someone like Damian Lillard, who when it was not going to happen in Miami, he looked at Brooklyn and said, I would like to go there, largely because Mikal Bridges is already there. I just want to throw it out there to the people that the longer the Nets continue to hang around and be a legitimate postseason threat, even with Ben Simmons being sidelined with another back impingement, which I don't want to speak out of turn, but I don't think this is anything compared to what the previous setbacks have been. I think there's a lot of optimism around Barclays Center that this will just be a minor setback and he'll be back on the floor. He was playing pretty awesome before the injury. I just want to whisper, pretty awesome, relatively speaking, for what he was the last couple of years.
Sure.
I just want to throw Mikal Bridges and the Nets back out there to the people, just to keep in the back of your mind for when a big gun decides I want to go elsewhere, that Brooklyn is going to be a real threat. They've got plenty of picks from the Kevin Durant stuff. They have no money on their books for the 25-26 season, aside from Mikal and Cam Johnson. And they've got tons of two-way players like Dorian Finney-Smith, who's had a resurgence this year after really a terrible showing post-trade deadline. Like, the Nets batted away offers for him after they got him right away from Dallas and seemed to maybe be regretting that come April when the year ended and he just didn't return to form. But he's looking more and more like the DFS that became DFS and not just a guy from Florida in Dallas. Royce O'Neal continues to fly by and knock down threes with everyone. There's stuff, and Cam Thomas. There's stuff happening in Brooklyn that I wrote about in greater detail that I would love for people to read about. where I think, I mean, and Mikhail is at the center of it all. So any words from you, sir, who's been to a couple of Nets games this year, just about what the 6'6" long, long, long dude from Villanova can be and is becoming?
Yeah, he's given more opportunities on the ball and to create. He has looked super comfortable doing it. The interesting thing to me at the start of the season was everything was sort of set up for, it looked like it was set up to be his team and to be, he's going to be the one taking, you know, the lion's share of the, you know, shooting possessions and sort of like, where this is, can he become an all-star this year? That's like the next level of his progression. And then kind of Cam Thomas comes off the bench and sort of says like, actually, and then averages 27 points a game and winds up getting himself into the starting lineup and becoming a focal point offensively. And there was like, I kind of won, that'll be something that I'm interested in how that evolves. Cam Thomas is now out with a sprained ankle, going to miss, I think, another week at least, something like that they're expecting. I looked this up because I thought it was interesting from pbpstats.com. When Cam Thomas is on the floor, Mikhail Bridges' usage rate is 23.3% of Brooklyn's possessions. When Cam Thomas is off the floor, it's 28.9. So with Cam Thomas on the floor, Cam Thomas's usage is like all-star level. And Mikhail Bridges becomes a little bit more of a complementary piece playing off the ball because he fits everywhere. He can be your spot up 3-and-D shooter. He can be, second side action, you know, swing creator, all that kind of stuff. When Cam Thomas is off the floor, then it becomes a little bit more Mikhail Bridges' show. And I think the interesting thing to me is it seems like that's the better and healthier ecosystem for Brooklyn moving forward, is more of an ecosystem built around Mikhail Bridges. And then, as you said, what does that showcase for a potential star? But Cam Thomas gets buckets, dog. So like, it might just be like, if he's on the floor, the possessions become about him one way or the other. So how that all sort of melds together, I think, is interesting, because Mikhail Bridges, the sky's the limit for him. And he feels like he fits sort of wherever you would need him to fit. But also more opportunities for him to step into the spotlight seem like it would be a good thing holistically for the Nets.
One player who has stepped into the spotlight this season, and then we'll get out of here. We've run a little bit long. He is only 21. He is battling giants. On the day he was born, LeBron was a junior in high school. Alperen Sengun, who the people call Alpi, he's averaging 19.4 points, 8.2 rebounds, 6 assists a game. Dan, I just want to throw this out there. There's a mystery player who in his 21-year-old season averaged 18.5, 10-6. Who do you think that is?
Was it Jokic?
It was Jokic.
All right. Yeah, I had a feeling.
The comparisons are there, man. He's got a lot of high post touches where he can be a threat to shoot it. He can put it on the deck and pepper passes to the corner. He is what I have long said, what Jahlil Okafor was supposed to be, but maybe he's even better. Maybe he's even better than that. He's got the low post footwork. He's got the Dirk Nowitzki one-legged fadeaway thing that is not a Dirk Nowitzki one-legged fadeaway thing. He just looks at you in the eyes and into your soul and sticks up his knee to the point where it's like a crane kick and Karate Kid and you think he's going to chop you, but instead he just shoots it and it's a feathery touch into the basket.
You have to stop doing that. You have to.
I love Alperen Sengun.
Yeah, we all love him. Stop doing that.
He's one of my favorite guys on League Pass to watch. Maybe that's a segment we can do. Favorite players of the year right now. He's one of them. Yeah,
that's fine. Do whatever segments you want. Just don't do it with that noise. No, you're absolutely right. Sengun has been fantastic. I'm working on something on the Rockets heading into Friday because they have their, I think they have the Clippers in the in-season tournament, and they've been one of the big surprises of the early season. 6-3, 6 straight wins after an 0-3 start. Top 10 on both sides of the ball, which there's only like a handful, I think 4 other teams doing that, Philly, Boston, Denver, and Oklahoma City. So like championship favorites, you know, deep playoff run hopefuls. And then the Rockets, who've been bad for several years. And, you know, they went out into this offseason with a plan of, we're going to try to be serious. We're going to spend a bunch of money to bring in Fred VanVleet and Dylan Brooks, and we're going to hire Ime Udoka, and we're going to be a team that defends. And so far, so good. But, you know, it's you bring up But the Jokic point and the comp, it's an interesting comp that I hadn't thought of, but the Jahlil Okafor comp, the reason that Okafor didn't translate as much as to where everyone expected to was you couldn't keep him on the floor defensively, right? He couldn't defend well enough in space to make whatever his offensive gifts were hold up. And that was the big question heading into this season with Şengün. Like, you have reported, other people had reported that the Rockets went hard after Brook Lopez, another guy who made a ton of sense in that defensive spine steal kind of, makeover, and they didn't get him. Reportedly were pretty close to it, thought they were very close to it, but did not get him. So then the question is, like, is Şengün at whatever age, 21, ready to be the 30 plus minutes a game defensive anchor for a team that intends to be serious on that end? And the early returns are good. And part of it is they're not letting him just play back and drop coverage. They're, you know, letting him switch more. They're bringing him up to the levels of screens, sort of like the way Jokic defends, where you get him, you don't give everybody a runway to get downhill at him. You make him more engaged up top, take advantage of his hands, take advantage of his smarts and his ability to communicate. And the early returns have been awesome. You mentioned comp with Jokic. There's another sort of fun stat that I've got. We'll see if it makes it into the piece or not, but it's, right now, Şengün, there's only five players in the league with a usage rate higher than 20% that are true shooting over 600. So like elite true shooting and assisting on more than 30% of their teammates' baskets. So that's like, I'm a high usage player, I'm an elite shooter, and I'm a table setter. And it's Jokic, Tyrese Halliburton, Luka Doncic, Domantas Sabonis, and Şengün. So like there's two of the archetype that you are hoping that Şengün can become in Jokic and Sabonis there. And then two of the, you know, best table setters and, you know, like, near the league lead in assists in Halliburton and Luka. So obviously a long way to go to be on that same sort of level, but the trend line is moving up and, you know, for him and then for the Rockets en masse. It's been super cool to watch. And then you're absolutely right. Like, part of him is just, it's not just the production. It's that he looks wild as hell when he's doing it. His floater is basically a shot put. It's just like, ha, and he kind of like hucks it up there and it goes. He's throwing the ball behind his head an awful lot, maybe too much, but it's entertaining to watch. He tries stuff other people wouldn't really think to go for. And, you know, experimentation is entertaining in and of its own right. So if you can get that plus the production, so much the better. Tune into the Rockets if you get them on League Pass or you get them on one of the national games. They're worth a watch. They're interesting.
We want more Rockets and less Celtics Sixers. That's all we've got for you today. Thanks to John Gennaro for doing all the things he does to make the show look and sound great and for using the trade machine for good and not evil. Follow us on the various social media platforms that are out there. I am at Jake L. Fisher. That is at Your Man Divine. Subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you are currently listening on and leave us a 5-star review. That would be great. We thank you for listening and we'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Crew.